This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This week, the center apparently will not hold. Olympia Snow, Republican senator from Maine, says she will not run for re-election.
I do not see the polarization that now stands in the way of getting things done changing anytime soon.
Also this week,
the ayes are 51, the nays are 48. The motion to table is agreed to.
The Blunt Amendment, pushed by Scott Brown, that would have expanded moral conscience exemptions for health insurers, fails in the Senate.
And Mitt Romney edges out Rick Santorum in his home state of Michigan this week. His other home state, right here in Massachusetts, is up next on Super Tuesday.
And a primate research center at Harvard suspends work after questions arise over its animal welfare practices.
When we come across 4 deaths in the past 18 months, that's troubling.
Well, joining us now to review all the week's top stories is Peter Canellos, editorial page editor at the Boston Globe. Hello again, Peter.
Hello, Meghna.
Also with us today is Garrett Quinn. He is the Less is More blogger at Boston.com and a contributor to Reason magazine. Garrett, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's start right off the top with the big news from Maine and Senator Olympia Snow saying that after 33 years in office, more than half of that in the Senate, she will not seek re-election in November. Here's more of what she had to say at a press conference this morning.
What I like to call the sensible center has now virtually disappeared in Washington. And the reality is, it's nearly impossible to make progress without partners in the Senate who are willing to reach out from all points on the political spectrum. The reality in America today is that the electorate is increasingly becoming divided into red states and blue states, which elect people representing just one color or the other.
All right, Peter Canellos, your paper called Snow a lion of the center, I should say. She says there is no center to be a lion of. What do you make of her retirement?
Well, that, I think she speaks for herself. I think that it makes a lot of sense what she says. Her specialty is bipartisan cooperation, and there's not a lot of it going on right now.
Garrett Quinn, your thoughts?
This is another decline in the Northeast Republican. You really only have her, Susan Collins, and Scott Brown now, sort of represent really the Northeast moderate Republican, the Rockefeller Republicans that have been a dying breed for a long time.
Peter, I know this is something that you've talked about here on Radio Boston before. I mean, what are your thoughts along the lines of what Garrett's saying, that this brand of Republicanism that found its home in New England is just vanishing?
Well, I think it's still alive in New England. I mean, it's conceivable that she could be succeeded by another moderate figure in Maine. But what's happened nationally is you used to have the Democratic Party and the Republican Party have a tremendous amount of ideological diversity within them. And it was partly because of the somewhat, artificial construct of the solid Democratic South that existed until the 1970s and 80s. Largely a function of post-Civil War politics. And so you had these Southern conservatives who were Democrats in name being part of a Democratic majority. And so when liberals wanted to get something done, they had to reach across the aisle to liberal Republicans. And when conservatives wanted to get something done, they would go to conservative Democrats. And there was cooperation. Now the parties are very ideologically divided.
Garrett, we spoke with someone from Maine on the day after Olympia Snow sort of made that surprise press release that says she was going to not run for re-election. He told us that in the State House in Maine, there was actually like shouts of surprise. Nobody saw this coming. I mean, do you have a sense as to what the effect her departure is going to be, let's say, on the immediate makeup of the Senate?
Well, I think, there's no question, talking about the surprise of the story, there's no question that this was the biggest news story on Tuesday. I think this trumped the races in Arizona and Michigan, because this, it was pretty expected that Romney was going to win Arizona. Michigan was a bit of a question, but it looked like it was heading Romney's way. And then this came out of nowhere, and this really jeopardizes the Republicans' chances, I think, of holding the Senate in 2012, because she was pretty much a lock, I think, if she ran for re-election. She said that herself in her statement. In Maine, there was one Republican that was challenging her. There was this Tea Party guy. I don't think he really had much of a chance. I saw him when I was up there covering the caucuses. But, there's a wild card here. If Angus King gets into this thing, I really don't know. I mean, if the Republicans can hold it, because they don't have anybody, and they only have, I think, what, a week or so before they have to get somebody, get their papers in order?
Hmm. Peter, before we fully turn away from the Olympia Snow story, I do want to ask you something about this. You know, one could actually say, because there, you know, Olympia Snow feels that there is no center to occupy anymore, maybe that's all the more reason for her to have stayed in the Senate, even though apparently from her point of view, it's kind of a thankless job now. But doesn't her departure only just fully exacerbate the problem?
It could, and it depends who succeeds her up in Maine. I think that, you know, that one Tea Party challenger who was taking her on, it had already been noted that it had sort of obliged her to take more conservative stances to try to make sure that she would win that primary. And I think there was a little bit of sort of self-disgust in her mind. It's like, wait a minute, you know, if I can't just sit here and say what I believe and do what I believe, I'm not going to go through the charades that other Republicans, even conservatives like Orrin Hatch and Dick Lugar, are now going through to avoid right-wing challenges in their own party.
Mm-hmm. Well, Olympia Snow has obviously had a long history of breaking with her Republican colleagues, but also many times supporting them as well. But she broke with them on Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the federal stimulus. And yesterday she crossed the aisle to help vote down the Blunt Amendment. And that, of course, is the amendment that would have expanded moral conscience exemptions amongst employers and insurers regarding health care services. I mean, this has become a real point of contention between Senator Scott Brown, who signed on as a co-sponsor of the amendment, and his primary Democratic challenger, Elizabeth Warren. Garrett, what do you make of the fact that that the amendment was voted down in the Senate, and what impact do you think it might have on Senator Brown here in Massachusetts?
The role that this is playing in the Massachusetts Senate race speaks to the nationalization of this race. This is arguably, and maybe Peter agrees with me, but I think this is the biggest national Senate race in the country. And the fact that the argument over contraception has just grown. It started out really in the presidential race, and it's just grown and grown and grown with the Blunt Amendment, and now it's spilling into here. I don't really see what Scott Brown was trying to do by doubling down on this issue at this point in the game. Yes, it's February now, it's March, but I really don't see what he had to gain from investing so much time and energy into this one particular issue.
Peter, your thoughts?
Well, I think there might be some things that he thinks he could gain. I'm not agreeing that these are big pluses for him, but I think that there is a perception there are some Catholic voters here in Massachusetts that, you know, normally vote Democratic, a little bit unlike their brethren in other states, but would go for him if they felt like he was more of a defender of Catholic prerogatives. I think that secondarily, it pushes Elizabeth Warren to be sort of the woman candidate. You know, mm-hmm. She's out there talking about contraception right now and in somewhat, you know, loud and strident terms and stuff like that. But it puts her a little bit in a box. And I think that the atmospherics of her, you know, speaking out strongly as a woman are less appealing to centrist voters than seeing Elizabeth Warren with an economic message. And so he's throwing her a little bit off her game by this.
I think one thing we want to remember, too, is that there's been a lot of talk about how Catholic voters will react to this issue, how Catholics are going to vote on the issue of contraception. Catholics, we have to remember, don't vote as a block. It's not as if there is no longer this giant block of Catholic voters. They tend to be 55-45, mostly evenly divided. I think in the last election, the majority of Catholics actually voted for Obama nationwide. I think that speaks to the fact that this is not something that all Catholics are going to get behind, too.
Well, let's move on while we can to one more political story. This one, of course, presidential politics. Garrett, as you mentioned, Mitt Romney secured two wins, one in Michigan and one in Arizona this week. That takes us right around the corner to Super Tuesday next week, in which 10 states are holding contests, including right here in Massachusetts. So here's Mitt Romney after his win in Michigan.
Great thing about having so many in our family, we can cover almost every race. So Super Tuesday will be stretched, but we're going to find a way.
Well, Romney probably doesn't have to spend that many of his family resources here in Massachusetts. He obviously won the state primary in 2008. Expected landslide this time around. But Peter, let me start with you and ask you, is there any significance to the Massachusetts primary at all on Super Tuesday?
Well, it's a little bit of a bulwark for Romney. I mean, I think it's looking now with the momentum that he got out of Michigan, he's probably going to be quite competitive, if not win Ohio and win the state of Washington. So it's likelier than not that the story next Tuesday is going to be Romney breaking through. On the other hand, if he doesn't, if there's another setback for Romney, he at least can count on winning Massachusetts and Vermont, so it won't look like a complete, you know, anti-Romney, you know, romp. So I'd say the only significance that Massachusetts has is it prevents a total disaster for Romney.
Garrett, does Romney have to just, like, really blow Rick Santorum out of the water in Massachusetts? I mean, what if Santorum puts up, I don't know, decent numbers, 10, 15 points?
Well, here's the thing.
Peter's laughing,
10, 15 points isn't decent numbers. Well, if Romney got 85%, that would be pretty significant.
The one thing that I have loved about this race has been how we've all... It's like another college math class. How we allocate delegates is fascinating to me. In Massachusetts, and this is my understanding of it, if any Republican candidate cracks 15% of the vote, they are entitled to a certain number of delegates. So, I mean, some proportional manner. So let's say Romney does win the state, but if Santorum pulls 20%, say Ron Paul gets 15, who knows with Gingrich, it's not as big a slam dunk for him because Mass is proportional. And the bulk of the states on Super Tuesday are proportional, as is Washington on Saturday. So again, like on Tuesday night, I was staying up late, just running, you know, scenario, just trying to figure out like how this thing could end. And there's this distinct possibility that we could be here sitting back in this studio in June in the Utah primary. We'll decide who's going to have the most delegates because of the way they're awarded in this proportional manner. Just winning a state is no longer enough. Vermont, by the way, I should add, is if you get 50 plus one, you get, I believe, all the delegates. But that's still a surmountable figure, a significant figure for Romney to crack. I don't think he's cracked 50% in any state so far. And, the longer Gingrich stays in this race, the longer, well, Paul's going to go all the way, the longer Gingrich and Santorum stay in this race, you're going to continue to have this divided field. That'll just prolong it.
Well, one last story before we fully wrap up. This one not having to do with politics whatsoever, but rather primates. And that is, of course, regarding the Primate Research Center run by Harvard University, where four monkeys have died in the past 18 months. And the latest was just this past weekend. All the deaths have been blamed on human error. Here is some tape from Frankie Troll. He's president of the National Association for Biomedical Research.
This seems to be uncommon, certainly in this era of the highest standards of animal care at research facilities throughout the United States.
And it's quite astonishing that's been going on for so long at a place like Harvard, which is already subject to a lot of scrutiny. So, Garrett, what do you make of this story?
This is one of the weirdest stories of the year so far. The one thing that struck me about this was the manner in which these monkeys ended up dying. In one instance, one of the monkeys was still in its cage, and whether it was a lab technician or a student or somebody, put the cage with the monkey in it through this washing machine without even noticing that there was a monkey in it.
Although in that case, I think they didn't attribute the death to the actual going through the washing machine.
But I mean, there was another one too, where a monkey was caught in a net and it died after from some type of disorientation from an imaging test. I mean, this is strange stuff.
Peter, your thoughts?
Yeah, I sort of agree with Garrett in that there are professional standards for handling laboratory animals. I think that a lot of the problem at Harvard was compounded by the fact that they were being especially secretive about these things because they were afraid of animal rights extremists, plotting attacks or something like that. But, it may be sort of like those collections of air crashes, like when remember U.S. Airways had like three crashes in a row and everyone's wondering what is it the U.S. Airways is doing. I mean, it may be that there have been some genuinely unfortunate lapses over there, but that it's not part of a pattern of substandard care.
It's almost 2,000 primates in their lab, right? Is that... this is over the course of several years. I guess I wouldn't. I don't know what the rate of mortality is for monkeys in confinement with as lab specimens.
Well, especially due to human causes. But those questions still to be answered. We unfortunately don't have time to do that right now. But we do have a little time left to do our weekly hubbubs, and that's the story that didn't quite make it above the fold this week. And let's start with you, Anthony.
Well, my hubbub is news today that James Q. Wilson, the well-known political scientist from Harvard, has died. He died today at the age of 80. He exerted a huge influence influence on criminal policy, well known for an influential article he wrote in 1982 in the Atlantic Monthly called Broken Windows, which basically argued that if you fix the broken windows, if you attend to those small signs of social disorder and urban decay in cities, you can actually affect crime rates in a significant way. That idea still holds sway. It helps spur big changes in criminal and policing policies here in Boston, elsewhere around the country, including an embrace of community policing, which brings the cops much closer to the community. So that's my hubbub. James Q. Wilson died today, age of 80. Sad news. An important guy.
Yeah, as you said, hugely influential as well. Peter Canellis, your hubbub?
People have long noticed since Borders went out of business, there's been that giant empty historical store in downtown Crossing that's been empty. And they announced last week that Walgreens was going to put a mega store in there. We've been talking about the plight of downtown Crossing and the Filene site and everything for a long time. This is the heart of Boston. It's the heart of Boston's shopping district. It's where everyone went down for Christmas shopping in the old days and stuff. Can't we do better than a Walgreens, I have to say? There's a CVS
It'll have
right
an
next
escalator,
door.
Though.
There's a CVS right next door.
Apparently
but,
they're
you know,
going
there are plenty of places
of
to
thing.
Get inexpensive shampoo, but, you know, there ought to be something a little more elevating at that site. I'm sorry to say.
I love it. They'll have an elevator. Nice.
Garrett, you're hubbub.
Oh, I've been covering for Reason Magazine. I've been covering the Ron Paul's campaign for the bulk of the primary, and I'm actually headed up to Vermont a little while to cover the goings-on up there. But while I was doing some research this weekend, I came across something I haven't come across before with his campaign. His supporters are pretty rabid in their support. They really like the guy. So they've done a lot of things. They've made their own shirts, their own pamphlets, all this. But now they have their own chocolate bars. There are Ron Paul chocolate bars. You know, and they have this, you know, this whole thing on the back about freedom and liberty and like the gold standard. And on the chocolate bar itself is an imprint of Ron Paul's head. I tried to get a comment from the makers of it. They never got back to me, but I can't think of any other presidential candidate with his own chocolate bar.
That's great. And you have the right to eat as many as you want.
That's right.
Right?
And if you pay for them, I think if you pay them in gold, the Ron Paul people will like you even more.
They're wrapped in gold paper, I presume. Well, my hubbub is also food-related from sort of my neck of the woods in Brooklyn. They're a very legendary bakery, Jewish bakery there called Kupel's. They sell wonderful stuff, except for a day last month, they were actually shut down because mouse droppings were found on the dough of some of their baked goods, which they make, which is a real tragedy because it is a phenomenal place. So we hope they will be cleaning up their act, literally, and we can head back down to Kupel's off Harvard Street in Brookline. So that's my hubbub. Peter Canellis, editorial page editor at the Boston Globe, thank you so much for joining us, and have a great weekend again.
Thanks.
Garrett Quinn, blogger at the Less Is More blog at Boston.com and contributor to Reason Magazine. Great to have you. Thanks so
much. Thanks, guys. It was great.
Well, stay with us. The man who introduced Boston to real coffee is back in the retail game. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
His name is George Howell. We'll talk to him in just a bit. I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is Radio Boston.